It's been quite a year for the Mujahideen Khalq. The organization, known by its initials MEK, seeks regime change in Iran. The group's on a determined big-money campaign to get removed from the U.S. terrorism list. The State Department's review of their status is due in a matter of weeks. Whatever the decision, the MEK won't be able to say it didn't give it the old college try. The organization, accused of having a cult-like culture, has a slick PR campaign going in addition to a full-page ad in the Washington Post. They've purchased the support of dozens of politicians and national security experts. The Huffington Post lists 31 prominent people from both sides of the political aisle in Washington that have appeared at Mujahideen Khalq-related events. A partial list includes Evan Bayh, Bill Richardson, Anthony Zinni, former Attorney General Michael Mukasey. Folks from the security realm include Louis Free of the FBI and Tom Ridge, formerly of Homeland Security. And even foreign policy deans like Lee Hamilton have signed up and talked at Mujahideen Khalq events. Big supporters include Howard Dean and Bob Torricelli. We'll spend a few minutes talking about the group and its terrorism list status now with Nariman Safavi, who follows Iran and talks with us frequently about it. Hey, Nari.
Good afternoon, Jerome. Good to be here again.
Now, Nari, you've been on the board of the National Iranian American Council.
Yes.
And this is an organization that is kind of speaks out against the Mujahideen Khalq at times.
Yes. I mean, for disclosure purposes, you know, we are one of the focal points of the campaign against delisting of them from the State Department terrorist list. And we have been, you know, the organization, the history of the organization goes back to the mid-60s. When there were a lot of, there was a sort of something in the air around the world with young idealistic revolutionaries adopting leftist ideologies and being fascinated by people like Che Guevara and Mao and engaging in campaigns of armed struggle against imperialism.
So the Mujahideen Khalq is sometimes described as Marxist Islamists.
Yes, yes. They actually, their inception goes back to 1965 to an organization that's called the Iran Freedom Movement. And these were people who were had moderately Islamist tendencies in the Iranian politics, but they separated from them because they thought they were too right-wing and they were just too moderate and too liberal. And they actually split. They adopted this sort of a, it's very similar to the liberation theology movement in Latin America that tried to integrate some sort of a theological reading of the scripture that's compatible with progressive ideologies of the time. And they tried to adopt some ideas from Marxism, Leninism, and Stalinism and try to incorporate that into Islam, a reading of the Islamic texts that approves those kinds of movements.
How did it turn into, a lot of people say it's a personality cult for its leadership, and how did it get there?
Yeah, it was actually a group of young, idealistic Iranian people who probably had very sincere intentions, and they just had, they adopted this problematic sort of ideology. But after they came out on the losing end of the Iranian Revolution in 1979, they were a part of the coalition that overthrew the Iranian monarchy in 1979. But when the reign of terror emerges in these revolutions and people, former coalition members, start to kill each other and to start to purge one another, the Mujahideen came out on the losing end, and they had to basically move to Iraq and be basically completely co-opted and adopted by the Saddam Hussein regime. And at that time, a lot of the ideological tendencies of this kind of this organization evaporated, and they basically got into a survival mode. And I think the leadership of it, which at that time ended up the surviving leadership of it was people like Masoud Rajavi, they started to use cultish kind of a tactics to help the organization survive.
And no one really knows where Masoud Rajavi is right now, but his wife wants to be the next president of Iran.
Yes, Mariam Rajavi. I mean, this is sort of a very indicative of the culture that these organizations come from. After he married Mariam Rajavi, who was the wife of another high-ranking member of the Mujahideen's Politburo, he advised his Politburo member that he should divorce his wife and he should marry her, and he will appoint her the future president of Iran. And so he married Mariam Rajavi and made her the president of Iran.
Now, the United States had a long history with the Mujahideen Khalq, and when they got kicked out of Iran and came to Iraq, the U.S. was big supporters during the Iran-Iraq War. This was an organization the U.S. got behind. They had offices in Washington. They were doing a lot of lobbying, and politicians were thick as thieves with them.
Yes. What happened is that they basically became a part of the larger strategy of Saddam Hussein's government, which at that time was very pro-American in its approach towards Iran. And they were allowed some latitude in the 80s to be able to do some lobbying in Washington, D.C. They had an office in Washington, D.C. Actually, in the early days of National Iranian American Council, when we organized around in 2001, when we would go around to offices of people, members of Congress or Senate, they would mistake us for the Mujahideen Khalq. They thought that's the only Iranian lobby that exists. And that would be something that we had to clear with a lot of people, that we are a very different organization from them. And yes, and they were at times supported by U.S. government.
What did they do to get on the terrorism list?
Well, they had a history in Iran in 1970s of killing American officials in Tehran, especially U.S. military personnel. So they never had a really good history vis-a-vis the United States, and they were always avowedly anti-imperialist. What happened is that when things kind of went sour with the United States and Iraq around the first Gulf War, and Saddam Hussein, while he was trying to, after the war, his military was at a very disadvantage. He was not sure if he could put the country back together afterwards. So he had a lot of his military dedicated to putting up the Shia uprising in the south in 1991, right after the war. But he couldn't quite handle the Kurdish part of Iraq to the north. So he asked the Mujahideen Khalq, which at that time had about 3,000 warriors and had participated with the Iraqi army in 1988 in the last stage of Iran-Iraq war to fight against the Iranian military. And he asked them to help put up the Kurdish uprising. So some of the massacres of the Kurdish people in 1991 that was supposedly done by the Iraqi army was actually outsourced to the Mujahideen Khalq.
And this is why the Kurds and even the Shiite government are pretty anxious to get rid of the Mujahideen Khalq camp that is still in Iraq.
That is actually one of the most amazing things, that people were thinking that in 2003, after Saddam Hussein's government fall, there might be massacres happening, because they thought that some of the Kurds and the Shias would probably just go into Camp Ashraf, where they were based, and basically kill everybody. And I, from what I hear from several different news sources, also one of the people who really detested them was then Secretary of State Colin Powell, who wanted to get rid of them and wanted to shut that base down. But somehow, miraculously, somebody in the Bush administration managed to keep that camp, to convince people in Iraq to keep that camp standing as it is and allow them to still operate from there. I think somebody convinced President Bush and went against Colin Powell's advocacy that this could be a bargaining chip to be used against Iran at some point in the future.
Now, the Mujahideen Khalq is supposed to have good relationships with U.S. intelligence, and we get, all these people who are testifying for the Mujahideen Khalq are saying, well, we've worked with them in the past, and they've helped us, and they've helped us with this Iranian bomb thing. They gave us this big information back a few years ago, and it proved out to be credible, and that's the thing that the IAEA took off and ran with, and that was the Mujahideen Khalq. They're good guys.
Well, that may be so, and it's very hard. You know, the intelligence world is very, very opaque, and one cannot know for sure. But I also read things here and there that they may not really have much in terms of intelligence assets within Iran, the Mujahideen Khalq, but this information that is coming out supposedly from their sources is information that's being fed to them by other government intelligence sources.
Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker said it was the Israelis who gave them the big dirt on the Iranian program.
Exactly. And there is also news accounts about in 2003 when they were thinking about shutting the Camp Ashraf, that Israeli generals and Israeli intelligence people were some of the first people to get to Camp Ashraf and debrief some of these people about what's going on.
You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and I'm speaking with Narman Safavi, and we're talking about the Mujahideen Khalq and their campaign to get off the U.S. terrorism list. Now, they're an organization that did do a lot of terrorism-like acts inside Iran. They went inside and killed prominent politicians, prominent people in the government. They take credit for blowing things up. They do things like that.
Yeah. If you ask the Iranian government, even to this day, who is your biggest enemy, number one, they would not even say United States or Israel. They would say Mujahideen Khalq. Because in that reign of terror, right in the post-revolutionary period, the Mujahideen Khalq were responsible for some of the biggest bombings and killings of the officials of Islamic Republic. One very famous one in 1981, in June of 1981, in which supposedly 72 people there was a sort of a suitcase bomb situation where some of the highest ranking members of the Iranian government were meeting, and supposedly 72 people died in that one bombing. I don't know if the 72 figure is actually correct, because Iranian government tends to fudge the facts to fit the Shia mythology, because that was supposedly when Imam Hussein died and the 72 martyrs.
Uh-huh.
So they kind of tried to adopt some of that mythology. I don't know, but we know it was somewhere between 60 to 80 people who actually died in that bombing.
All right, and they've done a series. They had a series of bombings in Europe that got them in trouble as well.
Yes, they have done some bombings in Europe. They have killed people in Europe, Iranians and non-Iranians, and they have. There is a whole host of all kinds of terrorist acts, which are not necessarily even directly attributable to them, but one would guess that they are probably responsible for.
Now, do we get to a point here where their close ties to the United States, their past and everything, and we've got to figure out what to do about this organization now because of the problems with the camp? When the U.S. leaves Iraq militarily, there's a lot of people who seem genuinely worried that all these people have nowhere to go. They're stateless in some way, these 3,400 families, essentially.
Yeah.
And there's going to be some sort of tragedy. We've got to do something with them, and getting them off the terrorism watch list is part of that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, about the relationship with the United States, I don't know if the United States has always been supportive of them at times. I think there were elements within the U.S. government who have been supportive of them at times. I don't know if there was a holistic policy to support the Mujahideen. I know of a lot of people who have worked in the U.S. government who are completely abhor this organization, and they don't want to have anything to do with them. We also know that even as late as 2001, when the September 11th happened, Masoud Rajavi was one of the people who praised bin Laden for what he did. So even at that point, you know, when the United States was on very sour terms with Saddam Hussein, they were as anti-American as anybody else could be. So it's always been a sort of a back and forth kind of a relationship.
Are we in a point, though, where to move forward? I read an interesting piece in The Guardian by an Iranian-American professor at Rutgers who said, mm-hmm. You know what? Why don't we get them off the terrorism watch list? I don't think they're such great guys, but if we at least push them to the political realm, and we're kind of defanged them. They've given up a lot of their arms and things. We would be doing ourselves and our relations with Iran a favor if we managed to kind of dissipate their effectiveness by legalizing them.
Yeah, that may be the case, but the history of the organization speaks against that kind of a thing. I remember when I was a teenager, just having come to Chicago in the late 70s, and if you went to the O'Hare Airport, you would not only just be getting harassed by the Moonies and everybody, the Mujahideen al-Khalq would be there to try to, if they saw you as an Iranian, they found that you were Iranian, they would try to recruit you. If not, they would try to solicit you for some donation. They have always had this sort of a cultist kind of a mentality, and it would be very hard for me to see that the culture of the organization would change. A lot of the people who are in Camp Ashraf right now are people who have been children of former Mujahideen al-Khalq organization. And they have lived in that environment where that is the only environment that they know. They have been completely brainwashed as children. And the Mujahideen al-Khalq also, in its negotiations recently with the United States and the Iraqi government, their leadership, because they could be prosecuted as war criminals and having done crimes against humanity, they have actually tried to use their own rank and file membership as a leverage, and they have threatened mass suicide in their camps, in their organizations, if they are prosecuted. So that is on the record. I don't foresee the culture of this organization changing.
Who are the people who are supporting this organization? Because if they've got a lot of money, and they seem to pay a lot of speaker fees here, they're paying for big ads in the Washington Post, they have their own internet TV channel that solicits money, and they've got a very slick campaign and always have. Who's supporting them?
Yeah, they have one thing that one could admire them for is that they are very well organized, and they have done some very impressive acts of organization. It seems like they are very much like other cult organizations that you hear about. They do get put their hooks and their fangs into finances of their members, and they basically use strong arm tactics to make sure that they will pay them money in the future. They have basically, like a lot of other cults that have become very prosperous, they use similar tactics on their members to finance their future.
Last question. We've just got like 30 seconds here, but
sure.
Which way do you think the government is leaning on their terrorism status?
Well, it's very alarming, because there has been uneven enforcement of the laws by the U.S. government in terms of them operating even while they are on the terrorist list. And the silence that there has been coming from the U.S. government and some of the officials is very alarming, because on any other organization, there would be a sort of a clear-cut denouncement of such an organization. So I don't really know, but I think it's all about politics, inside politics going on in Washington, D.C., and who's going to come out on top, I'm not sure yet.
It's a very interesting case. Thanks a lot, Narman Safavi, for coming and talking to us about the Mujahideen Khalq.
Thank you very much.